outside accounts rather than in the state treasury. It says CSU accumulated the surplus from 2008 to 2018. That is, during the same time it nearly doubled student tuition. CSU did not fully inform lawmakers and students about the surplus. CSU's chancellor said in a statement the report was misleading. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area: sunny, highs in the mid to upper 70s around the bay, mid to upper 80s inland. And Fresno in the central San Joaquin Valley: sunny, upper 80s to low 90s. This is KPFA, KPFB Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 Fresno, K248BR 97.5 in Santa Cruz, online at kpfa.org. Coming up on 6 a.m., Democracy Now! Is next.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, The Struggle with Alyssa.
Tune in to KBOO on June 22nd and 23rd for our live broadcast for Good in the Hood Multicultural Festival. We'll start the broadcast from King School Park and Good in the Hood Saturday at 2 p.m. Bands include the Elliot Young Band, Hot Tea Cold, Ronnie Wright, Cool Breeze, and more. Sunday, we'll start the broadcast at noon and we'll feature Funky Fusion featuring Amanda Ryan, the Norman Sylvester Band, Soul Vaccination, and more. Again, that's Good in the Hood, a multicultural music, arts, and food festival celebrating diversity and connecting people with resources and experiences to strengthen unity in the community. The broadcast will be Saturday, June 22nd from 2 to 10 p.m. and Sunday, June 23rd from noon to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Clark College Hanna Hall in Vancouver, Washington. The theme of the 7th annual Juneteenth celebration is Together We Rise. This theme addresses the idea that together we rise above the fray of hatred, despair, and discord. The celebration features a job fair, panels, awards, contests, an art gallery, live entertainment, and more. Again, that's the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Clark College Hanna Hall, 1933 Fort Vancouver Way in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
From the Heart with my two guests, Bouton and Carrie, who are both in the house scene in Portland, Oregon, and are two trans femmes that I'm very glad to call friends and comrades. I want to keep it going, though. I don't think it's enough to just do one show about Pride. Pride is a month. And even though we had our main Pride this last weekend in Portland, Oregon, a lot of other cities do it on different weekends. So I want to just keep it going so that if there are listeners from other places and your Pride hasn't come up, I hope that I can help deliver a spirit of resistance, of a spirit like Sylvia Rivera and her best friend Marsha P. Johnson. Together they helped to lead the rebellion that we call Stonewall at the Stonewall Inn in the West Village in New York City on June 28th, 1969. This year, in 2019, makes 50 years. And we're doing an event called Stonewall 50 in Portland, Oregon. The Q Center, which is on Northeast Mississippi, offered to open up and share space to commemorate the Stonewall Rebellion, the Knights of Action, that people who were living under state violence, state oppression, doled out by their foot soldiers, the police, who were just doing their jobs when they were bashing people over the heads, when they were putting trans women in paddy wagons just for being themselves, who demanded that you strip down and show them your undergarments so that you had on enough items of clothing that they thought correlated your sex as they described it for you. And if you deviated, well, then you'd probably go to jail. And for years, that was the way that things were, not just at the Stonewall Inn in the West Village in New York City. It was all over the world, including Portland, Oregon. And I think it's important to bring that reality back so that when you hear some rascally kids saying Stonewall was a riot and that seemed a little too antagonistic, I hope you consider that they're talking about real people's lives, people who were targeted for state violence and had it enacted on them to the thunderous applause of people the world over who felt like the police were doing the good work of bashing queers so that they would just go away. So pride is a way to say we're still here and we're not going away. And it's with that spirit that I want to keep the conversation going. So this week, I also brought on a trans woman, a friend and comrade of mine, and I'm going to let her introduce herself. We're going to talk about sex work decriminalization and what that has to do with trans women. And we're going to have a discussion about our points of view around this. Please introduce yourself.
Thanks, Alyssa. Hi, thanks for having me here. I am Paige Kreisman. I am the legislative and electoral chair for the Portland Democratic Socialists of America and a board member for Portland Tenants United. And I'm running for the Oregon House of Representatives in District 42 in 2020 in the Democratic primary. I recently got some attention in the news for being the first trans woman to run for the state legislature, but that's not why I'm running. That's not what my campaign's about. I'm running because we won this Oregon supermajority, the Democratic Party did, and what have we got to show for it? We've gotten a lot of compromises and handouts to the corporate class, to the 1%, to the wealthy, to the corporate lobby, the business lobby in Oregon that Democratic legislators take thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars from every year in campaign finance contributions. And we've been told that this is the best that we can get. We've been told that this is the best that's possible. I'm running. My campaign is about reimagining what's possible, reimagining what Oregon can be. My campaign's about fighting for the Oregon that we all know is possible, an Oregon that can build a Green New Deal, an Oregon that can have some of the strongest campaign finance contributions in the nation. We can join the 22 other states that prohibit corporate campaign finance contributions. It's about winning housing justice, such as real rent control, such as lifting the preemption on local rent control. And it's about defending our unions and our workers. So that's why I'm running. If your viewers, or sorry, your listeners rather, would like to learn more about that, page2020.com, as well as I'm having a campaign kickoff rally on Sunday at 1 p.m. at Hosford Middle School. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you for being on with me. I just wanted to bring on people from the community who have our lived experience to be able to discuss something that is a very hot issue in the electoral arena. So sex work and the criminalization, the continued criminalization of sex work, is something that matters a lot to trans women. And I have been open about my having to do survival sex work in order to fund my housing, my food, my healthcare, and my transition-related needs. And I think that it's a perspective that's important, not just for the discussion around sex work decriminalization or not, but about life, period. About political economy, about patriarchy, capitalism, white supremacy. It's all there when you are offering up sexual services. And I just want to be able to have an open conversation with other trans people about that. And while I know and appreciate that you said that your campaign is not about you being trans, thank God, because it's about your politics, and your politics are impeccable. And we're comrades in DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, together, and are revolutionaries. And I thank you, because of course you know that while your campaign is not about you being trans, certainly it's going to play a role every time someone writes something about you or shares something about you. It will certainly be sensationalized. And that takes bravery. And I know that you're already brave because of some of the things that we've discussed, and I hope that you feel moved to share tonight. But if you can talk a little bit about your stance on decriminalization and talk about how you know it relates to trans life.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I absolutely support unequivocally the full decriminalization of sex work. And I think it's very important for us to fight for decriminalization of sex works as leftists, as progressives, whatever label you want to call yourself. You cannot fight to dismantle capitalism or the cis-heteropatriarchy or white supremacy without fighting for sex worker justice. And we have the numbers to back this up. So just for trans people, the 2015 U.S. Transgender Survey by the National Center for Transgender Equality, it's the largest sample size survey of trans people in the U.S. In history. 1 in 5 respondents say that they've participated in underground economy work, such as sex work. That's 1 in 5 transgender people. 12% have participated in sex work for income, 8% for shelter, and 6% for food. And this is, of course, also tied to dismantling white supremacy, because of those 12% that have participated in sex work for income, 89% were trans people of color. And this is tied into so many other issues as well. Trans people are 3 times as likely to be unemployed. Trans people are almost 3 times as likely to be living in poverty as cis people. So you can't ignore sex work justice if you're trying to fight for trans justice. Otherwise, you're just fighting for trans justice for the privileged trans people, for white trans people, for economically comfortable trans people. And that's no way to fight for justice.
Thank you. I will say that most of the discussion that's already being had around decrim work, short for decriminalization, just decrim, which is how a lot of people who are engaged in some of the fights around sex work, decriminalization, but also just generally bodily autonomy and a larger recognition that sex work is one of the oldest and frankly most honest ways to come by money under capitalism. And I just want to name that most of the people who are engaged in this conversation are cis women talking to cis women. And we know that that is not making up the bulk of who is doing sex work. And in case any of my listeners are wondering, cis, C-I-S, is not a slur. It is quite simply a way to identify that a person who you're referring to does not feel any incongruency between the gender roles and performance and everything that goes along with that, doesn't feel out of balance with the sex that they were assigned at birth. And I've heard that that is fabulous, but I wouldn't know. And I just want to offer to people who are having these discussions to remember that, yes, cis women face a particular set of challenges and dangers when they engage in sex work. And that's at the hands of the state, at the hands of their clients, and everyone in between. But they are not the only ones. And I think that bringing in trans voices into this conversation is very important. And I just wanted to be able to hold that space in studio on KBOO tonight. If you had your way, right? So let's just say if you had your way, what would you do to bring some light onto this issue and perhaps even offer some answers to some of the questions that we are facing?
Well, first off, I just want people to take seriously that sex work decrim is possible, that sex work decriminalization isn't that radical. There's a lot of other places around the world and even in this country where sex work decriminalization is on the path to or getting to being implemented. And this is something that sex workers themselves support. This is something that makes communities safer because it reduces the amount of criminalized interactions between members and thus reduces the risk of violence from police. So this is not something that's some radical socialist or communist agenda that people should be scared of. This is something that is basic, fundamental human rights that we're talking about here. And rights and justice for sex workers are human rights. And we can absolutely achieve this. We can achieve this right here in Oregon. And we got one bill this legislative session that was pretty good, that was maybe a step in that direction, Senate Bill 596. This was sponsored by Senator Kathleen Taylor right here in Southeast Portland. This is a bill that the Socialist Feminist Caucus of the Portland Democratic Socialist of America lobbied very heavily for, and it provides amnesty for sex workers who wish to report a crime that occurred during the course of selling sex or some type of criminalized work, some type of criminalized sex labor. And this is important, not just because if a sex worker gets assaulted, then they can report it to the police without being feared of charging with prostitution, but it's also important for accessing healthcare, because if a sex worker is assaulted or raped, they can seek healthcare without fear of mandatory reporting or just some healthcare provider feeling it upon themselves that they need to report this person to the police for engaging in sex work. And that helps a lot, but it's not the end-all be-all. It's not the final answer to this problem. We need to move towards full sex worker decriminalization, because at the end of the day, even if sex workers can report crimes to police, what sex worker is really going to feel super safe walking into a police station to tell them about how someone beat them up, you know?
So I can only give advice to particularly young trans girls, a lot of them who come to me and want my advice, because we're not raised by trans people, or so few of us are lucky enough to be raised by trans people. So our mostly cis parents have a pretty hard time preparing us for the sort of trans challenges that we're going to end up facing. And the beginning of some of my trans challenges were precisely around police and precisely around sex work. So when I began to sell sex, yes, you have to look out so that there are no police that might be doing a sting. You have to be able to screen your calls. You have to be as safe as you can be. There are a lot of measures that you can take to sift out potential, you know, bad guys who would do you harm. And chief among them, whether there's a sting or not, in my experience, has been the police. So sting or no sting, and a sting, of course, is just when the police department gives the green light for officers to try to catch as many sex workers in a given time, in a given place as possible, and get them all in jail, get them all charged, and make sure that the numbers of crimes solved go up in the city. Oh, we busted them. So therefore, we're really good at stopping crime, right? So that's a thing, in case people are wondering. But even if there's no sting, a police officer has a particular kind of power in a dynamic where the person who is seeking your services knows that your services are criminalized or a criminal, you know, if you're on the right. You know, we say criminalized, things are criminalized, that a lot of these acts of poverty cannot possibly be criminal, but here we are. That you need to be afraid of dealing with police, because if things go sour, and things so often go sour in relationships that are attempted by clients to go further than just simply trading money for sex, but they actually want some emotional labor out of you. They want you to be their therapist. They want you to be like their mom. They want you to be like their best friend, their confidant, the person that they can tell all of their secrets to. And if that's a police officer, you might be in some trouble. And I have a lot of friends who are dead because they got in trouble with police and there was never a sting.
Yeah, absolutely. Police officers represent a tremendous threat to trans people in just everyday life. And it is because of that specific power dynamic that police officers have over everybody. But that's even more amplified for trans people. In trans women in particular, we don't have access to due process or immunity from cruel and unusual punishment, because when a police officer captures us, we're thrown into men's jails and men's prisons where we're raped and assaulted and spend long periods of time in solitary confinement. And if we're simply just captured by a police officer and put into a jail without a trial, we can face this terrible punishment simply for being trans before even being charged with a crime. So that threat is always there, that power dynamic is constantly in play. And that's something that all trans people are aware of. But when a trans sex worker is constantly aware of that, and they know that all of their very labor, their very act of paying their bills or putting food on the table or acquiring shelter is criminalized, then that just heightens that power dynamic to an even higher level.
So thank you for bringing up solitary confinement. So that was for sure where I wanted to make sure that I circled back to. So last week on my show, when I had on also two trans people, again, shout out to Bouton and to Carrie, So I want to just bring back a case of someone who died in solitary confinement. My friend, Laylene Polanco, Extravaganza, She was a trans woman sex worker, and we worked sex together. And she's dead. She died in solitary confinement. And my opinion is that if someone dies in solitary confinement, the institution killed them. The only job that an institution has, a prison has, is to keep you alive, keep you away from others, because you've been deemed an unsafe person, someone who's not fit to be with general society. All the good law-abiding people on the outside of prison, you know, like the ones that ruin lives through derivatives and mortgage fraud and banking schemes, loaning, lending out, taking the rug from under people's homes so that they can't afford their housing anymore. All those people on the outside of prison, you have to stay away from them because they're so good. So we have these prisons, and on your way to prison, if I was assuming you get convicted and sentenced, you go to jail first. And one of the most famous jails in the world for all the wrong reasons is Rikers Island. Rikers Island is one of those jails in the world that are dwindling in that they actually are on an island that you can't get to unless the jail wants you there. Rikers Island has turned out a lot of dead bodies in its existence. And one of the latest is my friend Laylene Polanco, who was in a diversion program. And a diversion program is what it sounds like. It's a way for the courts to divert you if you're a sex worker. And in Laylene's case, she was in a sex worker diversion program. These things that are supposed to help you. Except if you don't manage to do the program in the way that the state, the friendly, trustworthy United States of America has told you that it is the way for you to sort of not go to jail, you'll be diverted from jail toward freedom, and you're free to live another day outside of jail. And what sort of options do you have if you are a Black Dominican trans woman from the Bronx, who comes from a poor family, who's got a community of people around her that live a very similar lifestyle, because people who are cast aside and who are sacrificial people tend to find each other once they're thrown away and make community from being rejects together. So I was one of those rejects hanging out with Laylene. And we knew plenty of girls who had gone through diversion programs. Some of them make it during the span of time that they're in the program and they stay out of jail, but some don't. And then you go back to jail. And that's what happened to Laylene. So she got sent back to jail, and her bail was $500. It's called money bail. So they send you to jail, and you can leave jail if you can pay to get out. If you cannot pay to get out, you will stay in the jail until the judge will see you. Whenever the judge is ready to see you. Whenever they're ready to decide your fate, you'll wait in jail if you don't have the money. If you don't have the money. So Laylene didn't have the money. So she was in Rikers Island, where they put her in solitary confinement. She died in solitary confinement. And I've already said that my opinion is that if you die in solitary confinement, the institution killed you. I believe that the institution killed my friend. And I think that the institution needs to be closed. There's been a long campaign to close Rikers that's been partially successful. Shout out to my friend Darren Mack in New York City and the whole Close Rikers Now family. They got them to, well, excuse me, the coalition Close Rikers Now got New York City to agree to close Rikers Island. And they said, we'll do it, but we'll do it in 10 years. And there's already been people who've died while the prison is beginning to close its doors forever. I don't imagine that the standard of living inside of Rikers will get better in the 10 years that it's moving to close itself. Do you, Paige?
No, I do not imagine that the standards of living would improve in Rikers. And unfortunately, people probably will continue to die in Rikers as it stays open. And I agree with you. When someone dies in solitary confinement, when someone dies in an institution from a preventable death, then they're murdered by the state. And prison abolition is absolutely a crucial struggle for trans liberation. It's absolutely central to any type of struggle that trans people can undertake and that we are undertaking, right? You know, a lot of cis people, they think that trans issues are saying our right pronouns or, you know, not misgendering us, you know, accidentally or being sorry when you do or something. You know, that's good, that's fine, but, you know, we respect cis people's pronouns too. You know, they just get that for free. So you don't get a pat on the head for doing the bare minimum of not being a bigot. Our real issues are tied to material struggles. There's material manifestations of the cis heteropatriarchy. It's not just some abstract power structure that exists only in academia. And the prison industrial complex is absolutely one of those material manifestations. From that 2015 U.S. transgender survey, one in four trans women have been imprisoned in their lifetimes, and half of all trans women of color that responded to that survey have been imprisoned in their lifetimes. So this is something that affects a huge, huge amount of our community. I'm sure almost every trans person knows someone who has been imprisoned at some point, and we are faced with incredibly inhumane and incredibly rampant human rights abuses in these prisons and jails as well. So it's not good enough to demand that Rikers Island closes in 10 years. We demand full liberation now.
Sandra Bland said, if I die in police custody, I did not commit suicide. She said that before she died in custody. So Sandra Bland is still one of the heroines of the movement for Black Lives. And she became very popular online by posting inspirational and militant messages, mostly to other Black women, about fighting for liberation. And that seemed like an important thing to say, that if I die in police custody, it was not a suicide. I'm sending out the messages over the airwaves right now.
Yes, put my name on that as well. If I die in police custody, it was not a suicide.
If I die in police custody, it was not a suicide. So thank you for bringing up prison abolition. Can you talk about how you envision prison abolition and what it means to you?
Yeah, of course. I feel like every time you say that, you need to throw out a bunch of caveats because all the centrists and the right-wing people just lose their minds whenever you say prison abolition. Prison abolition, at least the way I view it, is not about releasing every single person in prison right now, this very second, this day, with no structures in place to support those people or to reintegrate them. Prison abolition is about removing the material conditions that make prisons and society necessary in the first place. Prison abolition is about removing the economic material conditions that create this massive prison industrial complex in the first place. It's often used as prison labor for profit. So it's about systematically changing the way that we view justice in this society to one that is rehabilitative and is not targeting so many marginalized and minority groups simply for existing, for nonviolent crimes and for poverty crimes and crimes of desperation and survival crimes, as is the case right now. The United States has more people in prison right now in this country than any other nation in the history of human civilization. And it's just absolutely staggering that this is not a mainstream issue. Not surprising, but staggering. It's up to us to build the movement that will get us there. We can't expect anyone to give it to us. It's up to us together to do that, and standing in solidarity with one another, because the prison industrial complex, it's absolutely was, I would say that it was created as a pillar of white supremacy. But you know, if that's not good enough for you, if you're a white person, a fellow white person, I'm white as well, if that's not good enough for you to go out there and you know, dismantle white supremacy, this also affects so many other people as well. This has also been weaponized by the cis heteropatriarchy and by capitalism to ensnare all sorts of people from every demographic. What we need to overcome this challenge is solidarity, and I believe that together we can build that movement that will win justice for all of us.
I'm so ready to build that movement. And just since we're on the topic, I just want to give a shout out to one of my first ever guests on the show, Ashlyn Ruga and Anna So from Critical Resistance Portland chapter. Critical Resistance is an organization that's been leading the way for how we envision prison abolition in a contemporary sense. So the way that it's described by some of the founding members of Critical Resistance and some of its lead thinkers, like Angela Davis, for example. Erica is a comrade that I met in San Francisco, where Critical Resistance also has a chapter. And thank you for helping me get to the convention. I went to the 20th anniversary there. It was incredible to be with so many people in one room who have a common goal of abolishing the prison industrial complex. But Angela Davis writes about the prison industrial complex and the necessity of abolishing it is that, like you said, Paige, it's a pillar of white supremacy, that when slavery was the law of the land, and that captured Africans and their descendants were kept in bondage their entire lives and were tortured into working for no money. And that's how the United States of America got so rich, by the way. If you've ever wondered, how is it that the United States of America, when you were in your history classes, when you were in high school, how is it that Chapter 1 was... when the pilgrims came and made friends with indigenous people, of course they didn't make friends, they slaughtered them and have almost driven them completely out of the population, but indigenous resistance persists. And I have nothing but solidarity for people that have a decolonial politic as well. But Angela Davis says that when slavery was the law of the land, and when slavery was formally abolished, the Emancipation Proclamation, 1865, we just celebrated Juneteenth, a celebration that started in Galveston, Texas, when there were enslaved people who found out that they were free, and they had a celebration they called it Juneteenth. That's June 19th every year. Shout out to Don't Shoot Portland. my first guest was Teresa Rafer, the founder and lead organizer of Don't Shoot Portland and one of my personal mentors. But again, Angela says that the rise of the prison as we know it today in its infancy began then. And there were people who were freed people, freed blacks, right, that were suddenly going to prison left and right for things like vagrancy, which is just standing outside and you don't have a job. That's illegal. And you're going to go to prison for that. So the reign of terror, some would say, the reign of terror that law enforcement began to visit upon black people that were supposedly free began in tandem with the rise of the prison as we know it. And that's where black people began to fill and live. And a lot hasn't changed. The United States of America is the land of the free, but like you said, Paige, has the highest concentration of prisoners in the world. The land of the free has the highest concentration of prisoners in the world. The land of the free has the highest concentration of prisoners in the world. Would you like to expand on that thought?
Yeah, so allegedly the land of the free. absolutely. And it's really evil in the way that we interact with the prison industrial complex as a society, and how people who are not victimized by the prison industrial complex are taught to accept this as normal, as acceptable part of a functioning democratic society. And if you look at the news, you turn on the news and you see something about some terrible dictatorship, you know, in some faraway land, and you hear about, you know, prison camps and labor camps and forced labor. And it's said in these scary, you know, these often scary words, which rightfully it should be, right? It's human rights abuses. But here, when we do it here in America, it's the rule of law and it's the justice system. And it's hard, tough on crime and prosecutors climbing the political ladder to become senators of California and run for president of the United States, et cetera. But it's the same thing that we're doing here and we have been doing. We've been running forced labor camps that we call prisons. And we've used that to target marginalized and communities made vulnerable by white supremacy and cis-heteropatriarchy and capitalism and colonialism and imperialism and all other supporting power structures that interact. And that's the same fundamental human rights abuse and injustice that we point to elsewhere in the world and don't look in our own backyard and see it right here.
So when I talk about intersectionality, I often roll my eyes at myself when I mention it because it's such an overused word. And I'm glad that people understand the concept and it's very widespread. I think even Hillary Clinton said intersectionality when she was running for president.
I'm sure she had a focus group that told her it was good, you know?
So I just want to preface what I'm about to say because I know how exhausting it is to hear someone say, my intersectional analysis leads me to see the connection between X and Y. Well, and no pun there because, of course, we're talking about trans women on this show. So X and Y are chromosomes, and one of the main reasons why trans women are dismissed as such is because their chromosomes may or may not resemble that of a common chromosomal combination of the sex that they were assigned at birth. And if, for whatever reason, a woman has an XY chromosome, she is just a man and will always be a man. And that is meant to cut us down and make us feel like we're, what, not worthy of being anywhere? Like maybe we should just not exist? like maybe we shouldn't be treated like humans. Like maybe you think we're less than human. Like maybe you think we're vermin. Like maybe you think you should exterminate us. Like maybe you're building a movement to justify those kind of actions for people who are not in favor of your fascist dream. Like the people who are marching in Portland, Oregon, and they call themselves patriots, like those people who are attacking trans people all the time. Anyway, my intersectional lens here makes me see that the prison industrial complex, of which we've been discussing, and the fight for sex work decrim, and again, more largely, not just sex work decrim, but about bodily autonomy, period, because the overlap between sex work decrim work and workers and volunteers and people who are fighting for abortion access, there's a lot of overlap.
Absolutely, yeah.
So shout out to all of my comrades who are doing both sides of that work together always. I cannot help but be reminded of the old adage that the reason that people who fight against abortion and fight for prison, who call themselves pro-life, you want live babies so that you can turn them into dead soldiers. That what you want is a lot of poor children who will have no option but to join your army so that you can exert your military dominance over the rest of the world. We call that imperialism. And you need to have a lot of people who are ready to lay their lives on the line for God and country. So you're going to need a lot of them. So you can't be having people who get pregnant thinking that they have options and getting abortions. And these actors who are limiting that are often the exact same actors who are trying to make sure that sex work remains a criminal act. So I just wanted to bring that in because these things are overlapping. They intersect.
Yes, they do intersect. How very intersectional of us to talk about that on our radio show here.
Hillary would be so proud of us.
Yes,
we're breaking the glass ceiling in the studio.
Yep, we're with her. anyway... So yeah, sex work decrim is very much about bodily autonomy, and it's very much intertwined with the fight for abortion access and safe abortion access. And it's really really disappointing that sex worker voices have been left out very much of the the mainstream abortion movement, right? The abortion access movement, as well as a lot of other voices too, right? Trans people are pretty categorically left out of the, abortion rights and access and reproductive health discourse. And it's very much something that trans people are on the front lines of. So first of all, people who have uteri are not just cis women. A lot of people who are not women can have uteri, and not all women have a uterus. But beyond that, there's other kinds of reproductive violence that is inflicted upon trans people. For example, on the federal level and in many states, in order to access basic identity documents, trans women have to be sterilized, have to undergo a process of forced sterilization. So, for example, when I lived in Colorado when I was 20 years old or so, I had been on HRT, hormone replacement therapy, for around 6 months or so. I needed a driver's license. In order to get a driver's license with an F on it, with a female gender marker, I had to provide documentation from a doctor that said I'd been on hormone therapy for a specific amount of time, which causes sterilization. So we're deprived of the ability to reproduce just to access basic identity documents like a driver's license or a passport. Oregon doesn't require that for a driver's license, but on the federal level, a passport, it does still require that for Oregonians. But in most states, it is the case. So that's very much a fundamental reproductive justice issue that trans people are categorically left out of, as well as the fact that a lot of trans people do have uteruses who aren't necessarily women. So it's not just a women's issue, but it is an issue of cis-heteropatriarchy, absolutely, that does affect cis women as well.
So now we've got to say what cis-heteropatriarchy is. So I've already laid out a little bit like what cis means, and again, I'll just say it. It just means that you don't feel any incongruency between your gender presentation, your social gender performance, and the sex that you were assigned at birth, and you don't feel any misalignment there. We would call that cis, and I would say congratulations. And we have to say what heteropatriarchy is, if you can lay it down, Paige.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to start with understanding that, should I start with understanding that people know what patriarchy is, at least?
Just say it.
Okay, so the cis-heteropatriarchy is a power structure that is, main goal is to reproduce and defend the hegemony and societal power and influence of cis-hetero men. Cis being not trans, hetero being straight, and it plays itself out in material manifestations. That's what I always bring up when I talk about these kind of things, because they very much struggle, concepts like cis-heteropatriarchy sometimes struggle to come out of academic settings and into the general political discourse, because a lot of people roll their eyes and think that's just, you know, some gender studies academia type thing, but it has material impacts in people's lives. We can point to these things. We can name them. We can name them as not having access to reproductive health care. We can name them as the prison industrial complex. We can name them as colonialism and the erasure of non-cis identities in indigenous communities through white European settler colonialism. And we can point to these things and we can say people are suffering and have died from this power structure that we call cis-heteropatriarchy. And if we can name it and if we can point to it, then we can destroy it. And together we can do that.
I'm ready to help you. So again, for my listeners who may have tuned in after the introduction, today, I'm speaking with Paige Christman, a trans woman who is in favor of sex work decriminalization and is also running for office. And I just wanted to give you a chance again to reintroduce yourself in case people did not hear you in the beginning, as we actually begin to close.
Thanks. So yeah, I'm Paige Christman. I'm the legislative and electoral chair for the Portland Democratic Socialists of America, a board member for Portland Tenants United, the largest tenants union in the city. And I'm running for the Oregon House of Representatives in District 42 in the 2020 Democratic primary. I'm running as a open Democratic Socialist. I'm endorsed by the Portland DSA. I'm running because Oregon won this Democratic supermajority last midterms, and so far what we've got from it is compromises and handouts to the corporate class, handouts to the 1%, handouts to the Oregon's business lobbies, and we've been told that this is the best that we can get. We've been told this is the best we can do, and I don't accept that. I believe that together we can demand an Oregon that we've always known as possible. We can reimagine what Oregon can be, an Oregon that centers justice and equity, and that builds a state that puts people over profit.
Fabulous. I want to just let people know again that it's Pride Month as well. June every year is when we commemorate the sacrifices of trans and queer people who have come before us and have fought and done incredible work. The Stonewall Rebellion is one huge contribution to humanity. And so we honor the people who fought in Stonewall. And of course, Stonewall, again, for people that were not able to tune in the introduction, was a series of riots, a urban rebellion in 1969 in the West Village in New York City that emanated out of a place called the Stonewall Inn, a bar that's still there. It's registered with the National Historical Places If you can ever go to New York City, make sure you go to the Stonewall. And it was the site of a community uprising against state violence, against police brutality. Because back then it was illegal to be trans or to do queer stuff in public. Because people had managed to organize themselves in such a way that it was indecent, and your indecency was criminal. So the police could just pick you off. And some of the people who led that rebellion were trans women sex workers who were thrown out of good upstanding society and were like street people, like pariahs, who everyone just knew they were better than. And two of them are very important revolutionaries who we should always remember, who were trans women of color, Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera. And I know that we are standing on their shoulders, and that trans women with a framework toward total and collective liberation have a lot of work to do. And it's really hard to do this work. So when I see that someone's doing it, I just want to say, I see you doing the work. Paige, I see you doing the work, and I thank you.
Thank you. I see you doing the work everywhere, all over the place, all over town, everywhere I look. I see Alyssa doing all the work. So someone please help Alyssa, because yes, you're doing all the work. Thank you. And I very much see you. You're amazing.
We have a world to win. So if you've got some talents, if you got the gift of gab, if you can just have soliloquies one after another ready for the mic, then you better do it, because the world is going to like kill us all. So you should act like things are urgent, because they are. And if you can manage to get yourself out of bed, if you can manage to use your voice, if you can manage to put your body on the line in front of gears so that things can't move, like Bayard Rustin said, Black queer icon, then you should. This is Alyssa Pariah. My guest is Paige Christman. Thank you for listening. I'll speak to you all next week. Bye.
Meet me on the mountain.
KBOO wants you to meet us where the music's at.
You can see awesome live bands like Fruition.
That's right. KBOO wants to send you to a concert this summer.
Just enter the KBOO Summer Music Raffle, where three lucky winners will choose an order from three awesome events.
You could win 2 3-day passes to the Northwest String Summit, July 19th to the 21st.
A pair of Sunday tickets to Pickathon, August 4th.
A pair of tickets to Lord Huron and Shaggy Graves at the Oregon Zoo, August 12th.
Tickets are just $5, and if you buy 4, you get an extra raffle chance for free.
Enter at kboo.fm/give, or you can buy tickets in person at Music Millennium or Grendel's Coffee.
Deadline to enter is July 7th. See kboo.fm/summermusicraffle for full rules and details.
Enter now for your chance to win.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Good in the Hood the weekend of June 21st through 23rd at King School Park in Portland. Good in the Hood is a multicultural music, art, and food festival celebrating diversity and connecting people with resources and experience to strengthen the unity in the community.
The Good in the Hood parade will take place Saturday starting at North Williams and North Russell Street at 11 a.m. and KBOO will be broadcasting the festival live on Saturday starting at 2 p.m. and Sunday starting at noon. Again, that's Good in the Hood Friday, June 21st from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. Saturday, June 22nd from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. and Sunday, June 23rd from noon to 10 p.m. at King School Park in Portland. More information can be found at kaboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kboo.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work, to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle, every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
Join me every first and third Friday from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. From the grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and political commentary. We will ease your troubled mind with licensed mental health counselor Cheryl Jefferson, political analysis provided by the Prophet of Rage, and calling in from the planet of rhythm and blues, musicologist Professor Soul. From the grassroots, I'm your host, Lanita Duke, on 90.7 FM, KBOO in Portland.